done it. I don't know what I said.
Rosemary stepped out.
Good evening. The committee is reconvening. It is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing on Monday, March 23rd. The agenda includes three bills and a presentation. First on the agenda is Senate File 176, Senator Rosen. I'm sorry, right, Senator Rosen, please begin.
You.
Yes.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 176 develops a certification, thank you, for a community medical response emergency medical technician, or a CEMT, community EMT. This certification is designed to fill gaps in timely, essential follow-up after a patient discharge from a hospital. And Madam Chair, members, I do have the A1 amendment I'd like to move.
It's
a delete all.
We have a delete all A1 amendment. This is the first hearing, so all those in favor. Is it? I think we have the amendment, don't we?
We have the amendment.
Yes, we have
it.
Okay. I have it.
Yeah. Okay, we all have it. Sorry, Senator. Senator Rosen moves the A1 delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 is a culmination of at least three meetings with the stakeholders starting in February. It attempts to satisfy a number of concerns with this Senate File 176 that stakeholders had brought up. And I should say that this was introduced way back in January 8th. You can tell by Senate File 176. So the stakeholders include the fire service, licensed practical nurses, home health providers, advanced practice of the APRNs, and Department of Human Services. And also the A1 adds these stakeholders to the advisory committee to set rates and establish protocols for direction of the CEMTs, and it delays reimbursement report from 1 month to February 15th. And apparently, Madam Chair, have a letter that was sent from the Minnesota Nurses Association, and I just received a copy, thanks to you, Madam Chair, about this letter. And I'd like to just direct the rest of my comments to this letter that you have in your packets. And because some of the issues that, 95% of the issues that are stated in this letter have been taken care of in this A1 amendment. As you see in the first page, the language, number one, the language of the proposed legislation is overly vague and provides for broad authorization. That has been basically deleted. So that paragraph, what they're talking about, the 1.22 to 1.23 and 3.9 to 3.11, has been eliminated. And then in paragraph two, who is actually coordinating the patient's care? That is in the delete all amendment, section 3, paragraph B, and that would be a CEMT acts only at the directive of the medical director, which is defined in sections 144E.265. That's at the top of the page of 2.1. And then also in the letter from the Minnesota Nurses Association, they talk about activities of the community EMT. And if I could direct you to go back to the A1 amendment in paragraph D, it clearly defines what the scope or what the CEMT can do. It says CEMT may provide episodic individual patient education, prevention education, but only as directed by a patient care plan developed by the patient's primary physician, an APRN, or a physician assistant, in conjunction with the medical response unit medical director. And then it goes on and saying inconsistency with the patient's health care home. That is very, very similar to other established statute that's already in place with a community paramedic. And then also I would like to direct you to page 2, line 15 in the A1 amendment, that paragraph F. A CEMT may not provide services as defined in section 144A.471. And this clearly limits and lists the abilities of the CEMT in that statute. So with that, Madam Chair and members, this is an exciting piece of legislation. I'm very excited about carrying this, and I'd like to thank Senator Hayden for his previous work on this, too. If you remember back in 2011, we worked on the community paramedic bill together. The first year was getting all the stakeholders together and doing this groundbreaking, national leading piece of legislation that has really set the bar very high. And it's been written up in the paper how highly successful. I actually passed it thinking it was going to be utilized in greater Minnesota for some of our aging population. And it's been extremely successful in the metro area. With that, we do have supporters, the numerous fire departments, the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota Ambulance Association, the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association, and with that, I have Mr. Chris Parsons, who would like to testify on the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Parsons. Say your name into the microphone and begin your testimony.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Parsons, and I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. And I'm here today to express my organization's full support for Senate File 176, which continues Minnesota's long and proud tradition of delivering quality and innovative health care while simultaneously stemming the ever-increasing cost of health care to the consumer and taxpayer. The status quo is no longer a viable option as it threatens to bankrupt our state and nation. Minnesota's fire service, with its thousands of trained healthcare professionals located in every corner of the state, is perfectly suited to deliver the fruits of this legislation, whether it be urban, rural, metro, or greater Minnesota. Senate File 176 is progressive, it's bipartisan, and it has the potential to improve healthcare outcomes and control costs at the same time. It addresses gaps in the healthcare system that all stakeholders have explicitly acknowledged and provides for public-private partnerships that are already proving to provide system-wide benefits. Also, please consider that this legislation or that this is leading to the creation of services that are not currently being provided anywhere else in the healthcare system. I'm going to brag a little bit. Today's firefighters do more than fight fires. Almost all of Minnesota's 1,600 professional firefighters are either EMTs or paramedics, with thousands more paid on call and volunteer firefighters being trained at these levels as well. In fact, healthcare delivery is 80% of what firefighters do, and we do it 24 hours a day, each and every day of the year. Here are some of the job descriptions that I and my colleagues are asked to perform, and this is from the City of St. Paul job description for firefighter. We provide basic and or advanced level life support of patient care to ensure that life-threatening situations and potentially serious injuries are recognized and cared for appropriately. We determine the nature and extent of illness or injury and prioritize medical procedures and or treatment plans. We're tasked to observe, record, and report situations of patient medical facility or dispatch. And we're supposed to be responsive, respectful to patients, families, and medical facility staff. In addition to this, the professionals I represent deliver life-saving medications, read and interpret 12 lead AKGs, deliver other needed interventions, often at the scene of devastating accidents, or while immersed in the aftermath of a cardiac arrest incident with family nearby. We do not have the luxury of utilizing our skills in a controlled environment like a hospital or a clinic, but day in and day out, Minnesota's firefighters literally bring the benefits of the emergency room to the patient's side wherever they may be. Firefighters are also among the most highly regarded and trusted members of the community. We know the people of our communities because we are in their home hundreds of times per day, attending to their various problems. We see how they live and often can readily identify their needs. We are backgrounded, badged, and sworn to fulfill our duty of protecting life and property. Thus, it makes perfect sense for firefighters to be engaged in community medicine. The current pilot program involving Park Nicollet Methodist Hospital and surrounding fire departments is proving to be a successful public-private partnership. It's also spreading from the West Metro to the East with a partnership now with Regents Hospital and the St. Paul Fire Department. What I like is that the program is elegant in its simplicity, especially when you take into account the highly technical skills firefighters are expected to demonstrate daily. With this program, we are just simply visiting folks post-discharge and checking boxes. We ask, do you have your meds? Do you have a ride to your next appointment? Could that rug over there be a trip or fall hazard? We are providing reassurance, and in my personal experience and the data are proving that that's all it takes to avoid a costly ambulance ride, an ER visit, and a hospital stay. We are helping to keep people in their homes and out of the hospital, which is the most cost-effective and, frankly, patient-friendly way to deliver health care. In crafting this legislation and pilot program, we have sought consensus from all sectors of the healthcare system while being mindful not to encroach on the current services and skills being practiced by other groups. Professional firefighters, fire chiefs, LPNs, APLNs, and home service providers have all signed off on this legislation. Let's allow Minnesota to continue to be a progressive leader in the emerging frontier of community medicine by recognizing that there are many groups interested and capable of stepping up and providing quality health care at lower costs to consumers and health and taxpayers. Please support Senate File 176.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. I have Buck McAlpin. Are you wanting to go next?
Madam Chair, I can just go quick and then stand for questions with Mr. Parsons and Senator Rosen. Buck McAlpin, Minnesota Ambulance Association. We support this wholeheartedly. You all remember the community paramedic that Senator Rosen alluded to. We like that program. It had us work through some loopholes, and it was nice. That was tough legislation to draft because no one in the country ever did that. What's nice about what we worked on with this project is we had a lot of examples now as other states have tried to do something like this. Still no one has done what Minnesota's done with these large community paramedic programs, and the community EMT was the next logical step. And we also told the fire service in 2012, let's work through the community paramedic first, and then let's get to the community EMT. Senator Rosen hit it perfectly. We're using the large community paramedic models in our large Medicaid populations, mostly in Minneapolis, Hennepin, and Ramsey County. But the majority of our rural EMS is basic emergency medical technicians. And we now have to develop a tool to be able to roll that out more quickly. And we've been asked by all kinds of folks, both ambulance and first responder squads of our associations, of how we do that. And this is a step in the direction to have us get that done and meet some of those needs.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you. In 2011, we rolled it out. And I do want to, again, thank the department, DHS, for their work on that community paramedic and their work on this, too. They've really stepped up to the plate to make sure that it is covered. And as Mr. Parsons says, there is a pilot project out there that's been rolling out very, very well. And on a side note, too, in the broader picture of the work that this body is doing on, and you and I on our task force for child protection, this and what the firefighters do and how their access and their involvement in the community and the respect in the community, working on legislation to further develop some kind of relationship with these children that are in the child protection system. And the firefighters have talked to several of the chiefs, and they are very, very excited about hopefully unrolling something like this where we can use this wonderful resource further. And I think this is the first step that we can do. Talk to Senator Lurie. I'm not sure if he has anything that he'd like to propose to, but this is a wonderful project with great legs to it.
Thank you. Are there any questions at this time? Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, for Senator Rosen, for being amenable to a possible amendment. I haven't figured out how to work it yet. What we talked about was a little bit about the need for cultural relevance to be incorporated into the proposal in some manner. I was visited by the president of Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, and we were having a really good conversation about how, for a whole host of reasons, we've just had a real struggle attracting, you know, Native Americans to get on the career track, all the way from CNAs up to, you know, full-blown paramedics. This Tribal and Community College has considered being the next site to bring up a community paramedic, but they're worried about whether they'd be able to attract it. And so trying to insert that cultural relevance and into the training in some manner is something that we'd like to do, but I haven't had time in the intervening hours to try to exactly craft that. But we'll be looking at that. I think it's an idea worth consideration and would like to further the
Madam
conversation.
Chair, I think that's
and it's
fabulous.
Not just for tribal either. I know that, that other communities have really struggled to get people, to get their members on the career track to go out and help in their communities. And so some work to continue.
Okay, thank you, Senator. We do have another person who wants to testify, but before calling up John Tollefson, I have a couple of questions for this panel. I would like to ask Mr. Parsons, when you were talking about the way to utilize the capacity of the firefighters, how do you get engaged in the first place in the role that you're playing? How do you get called into participating in the lives of these people?
Well, first off, in our role as emergency first responders, we are often called, you know, into these people, into people's homes, and you know, we see the conditions in which they're living, and we can often identify needs that they have other than what the original call was directed for. As far as firefighters being involved in this area, most of us are trained to the EMT level. Almost all professional firefighters are, and many many firefighters are also paramedics. What this program would do, what we're doing with Park Nicollet, we are simply visiting people post-discharge from the hospital and just going into their homes, making sure that they understand their post-discharge instructions, making sure that they have their follow-up appointments scheduled, making sure that they have their that they picked up their meds from the pharmacy. What we found is that about 50% of people don't even pick up their medications after they're discharged from the hospital. So these are all situations that can lead to hospital readmittance.
I'm just trying to sequence it in my mind. So would your department, your firefighters department, has an EMT service within it? Is that correct so far?
We have a the city of St. Paul has a community paramedic
Community paramedic service. So you'll get a call that says something like what would the call be?
Okay. Madam Chair, the City of Minneapolis, for instance, they'll get a list of names of people that have been discharged and that have voluntarily enrolled into the program from Methodist Hospital. And if these people live within the City of Minneapolis's borders, they will send out a group of people that are working as community EMTs. So usually it's two people in a suburban.
I see. But I think you've answered my question. It is the after a patient's been come into the emergency room, then a list is developed of persons who might want some follow-up services, and that is then provided to you for your service. Is
yes,
that
but, my understanding? But it's mainly post-hospital discharge, right, not right. necessarily emergency room.
Okay.
But
okay,
they're in the hospital for maybe COPD, and they were admitted. And then they're given a discharge instructions. They're discharged from the hospital. They voluntarily enrolled into the program, and then their name kind of goes into a list that is then forwarded on to the city of jurisdiction.
And Mr. McAlpin, that's the same system that you're talking about using for this proposal in front of us now.
Madam Chair, members, the community EMT, Chris was getting into it there. I think it's an opt-in program, so they just don't randomly decide to drive around and say, we got a list of people who were discharged. When you're discharged, the nurse says, would you like to opt into our firefighter home visit program, like the St. Louis Park, when they've noticed about a 50% reduction over the 9 months in 30-day readmissions. So quite an impact. The same we're seeing with community paramedics across the board. So all part of a care plan, all part of a physician order, all part of a nurse triage follow-up is their dispatch strictly after their letter.
And so at the point that the nurse gets the opt-in program, in the bill itself there's language about a very specifically defined set of activities that person will carry out as a part of a, I can't remember what you called it here, a patient care plan that's been developed. And that, so once those names go out, it isn't just the names that go out. There is some kind of a treatment plan about what the parameters are for what that person will do when visiting that person's home. Is that correct?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Right. Okay.
And the supervision, do I understand, after that point, is the medical director for the service itself?
Madam Chair, two pieces. As certified emergency medical technicians, whether the paramedic, first responder, EMT level, we work under our EMS medical director's license, but this also allows the key of why this has worked in Minnesota is the primary care integration. So although Dr. Ho may medical direct St. Paul Fire or Dr. Francone is actually the medical director, they will have a relationship with Dr. Johnson, who's the primary care side, to work with the advanced practice registered nurses and PAs and the RNs at the hospital when these folks are discharged. And that's the key to the second year piece of this, the payment methodology study, is that's where we really develop services. That I know we've had a discussion with the M&A about the services delivered. Many of the services are decided at that second piece where we sit down and evaluate what they're doing with the program. So the first piece of this is like the community paramedic enabling certification. The second piece identifies some of those services. And then off those services, when the care plan's written, that's how we're paid for community paramedic. It has to say, Dr. Laurie has authorized a CP visit for wound care. And that, of course, is at the paramedic level, but for a CMT to do a follow-up visit 24 hours after discharge. So everything's pretty coordinated. Our goal always is we never want to duplicate services.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel? We have another testifier, Mr. Tollefson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Tollefson, and I'm a Government Affairs Specialist with the Minnesota Nurses Association. And with 20,000 members, the Minnesota Nurses Association is the largest voice for professional nursing in the state of Minnesota. We represent a majority of acute care nurses practicing in Minnesota hospitals and continue to be a leader in promoting the general well-being and safety of patients. We want to express several questions we have regarding the expansion of EMT duties and concerns regarding patient safety as proposed in this legislation. We want to ensure bill language reflects its intent. MNA shares a desire to reduce readmissions and unnecessary 911 calls that cost both local agencies and healthcare providers. Likewise, MNA has no objection to EMTs being compensated for addressing medical emergencies that do not result in a visit to the emergency room. We have concerns, however, that this proposal provides such broad authorization to ambulatory medical directors and expands the work of emergency medical technicians by allowing them to perform the same duties as a public health nurse. We are open to continuing conversations with the authors and proponents, as we have been doing for the past 2 months. The language in the proposed legislation is overly vague and provides for a broad authorization. For instance, the terms on lines 1.22 to 1.23 of the original bill, episodic individual patient education, prevention education programs, and on lines 3.9 to 3.11, again on the original bill, interventions, care coordination, diagnosis-related patient education, and population-based preventive education, all of these terms are not defined and could be interpreted by ambulatory medical directors in many different ways. These are all very nurse-related duties. Population-based preventive education isn't allowed to be practiced by an LPN even. And with respect, they were not deleted in the A1 amendment. And if, just as an update, they are on page 2.32 to 2.34. And then again on the top of that page at 2.6 to 2.8. But how EMTs, ambulatory medical directors...
Just to hold on just a moment here. We're trying to catch up with what you're saying here.
Excuse me.
You're indicating that things were... the things that you're talking about are you're referencing to their identification of what they can do in lines 2.31 to 2.34?
That's correct, Madam Chair. And I apologize, I was referencing the earlier legislation, but it's actually lines 2.32 to lines 2.34 when referring to interventions intended to prevent avoidable ambulance transportation or hospital emergency department use, care coordination, diagnosis-related patient education, and population-based preventive education. Those are all very nurse-related duties. And for example, population-based preventive education isn't even allowed to be practiced by an LPN. And then how EMTs, ambulatory medical directors, and patients' primary care physicians will communicate to coordinate that care is unclear. Will the EMTs simply depend on a patient's discharge papers to understand the discharge plan or actually meet with the primary care physician? What if a condition appears that requires changes to the plan? Will the ambulatory medical director know the patient for whom they are giving care orders? The legislation does not allocate money nor outline specific requirements for training and education for EMTs to perform care coordination and patient education, among other duties. And without proper training and qualifications in these areas and others, patient safety is put at risk. For example, even a four-year RN has to receive certification to perform diagnosis-related patient education in diabetes control. Under the present bill, an EMT with just 120 hours of training is authorized to do that. The activities EMTs would be performing under this proposal would be non-emergent, but it's unspecified which board retains regulatory authority. It could be the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board or the Board of Medical Practice. We believe it is essential for any person practicing healthcare to be overseen by an appropriate regulatory or licensing board. Now, MNA is a strong supporter of allowing EMTs to conduct home safety interventions that prevent falls or injury, collect medical data, and report data back to the primary care provider, as the proponents have stated. These services should all be reimbursed to the EMT's department or agency, but reimbursement should not be provided for any medical or nursing interventions, nor for any non-emergent tasks that require licensure. As written, we cannot support the proposal, and we ask the committee to clearly state the tasks that community EMTs could perform, such as those I suggested or something the proponents prefer, rather than provide broad authorization as currently written. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to add the A4 amendment, which is written to the A1.
Senator Eaton is offering the A4 amendment that will be distributed. Would you like to describe the contents of the A4 amendment, Senator Eaton, and what it accomplishes?
Madam Chair, Mr. Tollefson's basically described it in the but I don't know if you have anything else to add, Mr. Tollefson.
Mr. Tollefson, what does the A4 amendment do very specifically?
Madam Chair, very specifically, it would restructure the bill to delineate the services that a community EMT could perform and delete several of those very broad authorization terms. And I would add, Madam Chair, that with this amendment, M&A would support the continued legislation, continued moving forward. We would not be opposed to the legislation moving forward as peace in the valley, as some like to say.
So Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you. I guess I am a little confused about Mr. Tollefson's testimony, too, because some of that language that he was saying that's in there, I'm not seeing in the A1 amendment. So I apologize if I did misspeak on some of this, but I still think a lot of this has been taken care of in the work group. That 2.32 on the services, that was work group language that was what that was given. And I would ask that we oppose the A4 amendment. I think it basically decimates the entire bill and doesn't have any purpose whatsoever. This is supposed to be a continuum of care model that the community paramedic bill has proven to be very, very good with. And we worked through a lot of these issues back in 2011. And I hate to see this being picked apart. It's going to change the statute and really minimize what a CMT can do. And basically, when we did the community paramedic, it was to get at those frequent flyers, the people that were calling 911 constantly, and to keep them out of the emergency room. Now it's the next step to make sure that the folks that are coming out of the hospital aren't calling 911 again. So it's just the next step. It's not a broadening of any practice or territorial issues. This is just basic good community support system that we're putting in place. But with that, I do have Mr. McAlpin, who would like to speak to the A4 amendment.
Please speak to the amendment, Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and members, I'll be brief. Buck McAlpin, Ambulance Association. The one thing Mr. Tollefson talked about was under the Section 4, the 2.31, after 2.20 and down, that's all language to develop the work group to look at these procedures and skills that the CEMT will offer. And it's language that we've used in the past to work with DHS of how a fiscal note would be established, to even try to work on a federal waiver to get the match for a Medicare cover, the Medicaid piece of this. So although that whole section looks pretty vague, that's a lot of reporting language that we report back to that. And to the amendment, a couple things. This 1.5 kind of guts the bill and what they're going to do as CEMTs. And secondly, on 1.0, a CMT may not perform any non-emergent tasks that require licensure. The licensure would be on the nursing side of it. The CEMTs in Minnesota, EMTs and paramedics, are certified, and we are only one of three providers that are exempt from scope of practice because how we work under a medical director's license with a scope of training. So lots of things in that amendment don't even line up with what we do in that work sector of emergency services.
Mr. Tollefson, I did note in the A1 amendment, the language, this is in response to your indication that you would prefer very specific language about what more clarity as to the scope of the interactions. But there, as Mr. McAlpin was saying, that on lines 2.28, there is language that utilizes a number of stakeholders in the determination of the specified services and payment rates for the services to be performed by the community medical emergency response team. So they aren't defined here, but they are they are to be developed by this group of persons. Why is that a problem for you?
Madam Chair, our concern is that the what could be determined by that group could be any number of services that are far outside of the training of an EMT. And so it would authorize the commissioner to set up several different types of services that could be performed and without the supervision of, you know, this body. They would report back to this body in a year what those services are, so we would have an opportunity at that point to discuss this again. But this was, similar to the community paramedic process that went through, and that doesn't necessarily give an equal voice to all of those stakeholders at the table.
Did you say that according to your understanding of the A1 amendment, these recommendations that are developed by these groups would come back before the legislature, before this is implemented, or is that what you were requesting would happen?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding of what it would say now. So we'd still have the opportunity to review those in the future, of course. But my concern is that we would get to a point where broad authorization could be submitted in any of those cases. And we very much like the description of the program as the proponents have laid before the committee. And that's what we're asking be written into the law now, so that we don't have to have that conversation.
Madam Chair, in direct Rosen. Response to that concern, on page 3, line 13, paragraph C, it does come back, and it is listed that these services shall not be covered by MA until legislation providing coverage for the services enacted by law. So,
Senator Rosen, to that extent, could you talk, or maybe Mr. McAlpern, about the population-based preventative education? That language sort of is a red flag in terms of the specialized certification, even for an RN to go out and do population preventative. It requires an additional certification besides the basic RN. So there's lots of RN programs that don't have the certification for public health. So could you talk about that? Mr. Tolleson talks about that as very, very much of a concern in terms of the capacity of a person at this level, that it would be beyond the scope of their training.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. That also is under the consultation of the advisory group, so that's nothing that would be put into law over what they're going to do today. That is in there. It kind of mirrors what we did with the community paramedic. Use care coordination, diagnose-related patient education, population-based preventive education. Mr. Tellison's right. That's a pretty broad statement. And I guess if we asked everybody in the room, we'd have a different definition over what population-based preventive medicine is. That could be the fire folks making sure the rug's okay, making sure you have CO detectors, or that could be a registered nurse doing very aggressive care coordination. So that is a word, Madam Chair, that did come up in the House. I think that's one, if this committee graciously moves the bill forward, we should talk about that piece. But it's in the setting of the work group to work in the interim to decide if that's something that should be included in a service. I think we've heard enough concerns over that phrase in both the House in the last hearing and again here today and from the MNA, but that's probably something we have to work on that phrase.
Thank you. Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen, thank you for kind of going through this bill. We've been working on this together. I think we got a good start here. This sounds like the bill has some other steps to go. I appreciate Senator Eaton's amendment and Mr. Tolleson's testimony, but it appears, Ms. Tolleson, this is just maybe a little too aggressive for the stage that we're at today. I think that you guys continue to work, and if there's just phrases or actual, you know, this population or this preventative education program, if that doesn't fit well with the committee, I think that or fit well with the process, I think we could continue to work on that. Also, Mr. McAlpern talked about the nature of EMTs working under a medical director's license and how that interacts with the work that they do and who ultimately is responsible for what care they provide. And I think that that is a conversation that needs to be had. So I appreciate your organization really wanted to make sure that these EMTs and others are working within the scope of their training, I do think that your amendment is a little, is maybe does just a little bit too much to change the scope of the bill, as opposed to the collaborative conversation that I would hope that you're continuing to have with the proponents of the bill, as you would say, and Senator Rosen in particular, to try to flesh out some of these issues and make sure, because it sounds like we're saying, okay, here's kind of what we are thinking of doing, here's the group, here's what we're looking at. You're saying, well, this is what they are going to do, and we got to stop it. And that doesn't sound like those two tracks are on the same page. And Mr. Tolson, to be honest with you, if we legislated here on what might happen all the time, like, well, you just never know, they could just let these guys go do surgery. I just don't feel like that that's what a medical director would do. I don't think that that's what Senator Rosen wants. It's not his legislative intent. I don't think that's what Mr. Parson and the fire chiefs would allow their folks to do. So I just am not sure that we're quite ready yet to adopt your amendment, though I surely hear your concerns about making sure that the EMT folks don't get out of their scope. I'd also like to be able to kind of pull back in as you guys have the conversation, and I'm not volunteering to be there, but if you want me to, the conversation about the community paramedics and how it works to the community paramedics versus the community EMTs, the work that they're doing, if there's incidents of people practicing, you know, outside of their scope or doing things that are bringing harm to people throughout that process. I just have never heard that. I heard that it's been a great success and people are working well. So though I appreciate you wanting to make sure we don't go down a slippery slope, I'm just not quite sure that we're there yet. So, Madam Chair, I don't think that I'll be supporting the amendment, but I will continue to encourage Mr. Tolleson and others that may have some concerns about this language to keep working on it as we as this bill, if it gets through, heads to finance.
Thank you, Senator Hayes. Senator Nelson, I'm sorry I skipped you before. I missed your name on
Madam
the list.
Yes, Senator Rosen. I do appreciate that, Senator Hayden, and I think that this is a very essential discussion because we want the MNA to be a part of this continuum of care, this community support system. And I do just want to reiterate that the licensed practical nurses have been very much supportive, the home health providers, the APRN nurses. So we're going to get there. And I think that once, if we get there, it'll be an amazing springboard for some other things to happen going forward. And I did thank you for your work on this in the past, too, before you got here. But anyway.
I was in the back.
Senator Nelson, this is on the amendment, right? To the amendment?
It is not to the amendment. I will
okay.
say my
thank comments. You. And I just want to make sure, Senator Benson, do you have?
I don't need to comment. Senator Hayden
okay.
has spoken well.
So I think Senator Mr. Tolleson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to respond. We at the MNA agree completely that it would be good to have that working group process. Our amendment does nothing to change the working group process. It would still be determining what the actual services and rates would be. The only difference is it doesn't include this very broad authorization to have any number of different services on the table. It would simply limit the basic general types of services that could be performed. As others have said, the program, you know, when you have basic services being performed at someone's home after discharge, that can be excellent for readmissions and for frequent 911 calls, for, you know, reducing that. What this does is ensure that the language reflects what that statement actually says, so that we are going forward into that working group with parameters in place, so that we aren't going outside into tasks that are, you know, not as extreme as surgery, of course, but very much within the scope of practice of nursing, and making sure that we're not having people who are not trained or educated to perform these duties and who are not licensed to be performing these duties do that.
To that point, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Hayden.
So I agree, but I think that you've kind of jumped the gun. So I'd rather see you guys go through that process, and if for some reason you thought that there were a bunch of or there were things and that the EMTs were now allowed to do that you vehemently oppose, then I think that would be the time to kind of come back and really engage us and tell us why. I just don't think that to limit the conversation in that way would not be productive and frankly might inhibit the ability for EMTs to go out there and kind of do the things that Senator Rose and Mr. McAlpin are saying, and frankly the firefighters the same that they can do. So I just think we may have a difference of opinion on the pie, if you will, and how we should look at it and how we should cut it. And I don't think we should limit it today. I think we should continue to work.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen, and then Senator Eaton, then we should take an action on this amendment.
And well, Senator Hayden did ask a question if there had been issues with the community paramedic, if there was, because we've already had this discussion, actually, with that bill back in 2011, which is a very good discussion. So I'm asking my testifier, have we had any issues with the community paramedic?
McAlpin. Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, DHS just came in and audited many of the major systems on our compliance with their statute and found us to be fully compliant with what the law allows us to do.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In defense of the amendment, I would just like to say that my concern is for the individual patient or person being cared for. These people don't have a scope. They have 120 hours of training. And nurses have considerably more than that, and nurses require more than that to do a lot of these procedures or services. So I am not comfortable with putting in law that that's a possibility. I just think that we're going too far. This is a way to do something without having to provide nursing.
Senator Eaton renews her motion that the A4 amendment be made to Senate file. Senate file the A1 amendment to 776. Or 176, thank you. Any further discussion on that amendment to the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The amendment fails. Now to the A1 amendment. Any further discussion? I do have a couple of things. Senator Rosen, I wonder if you would consider adding some language at the end of line 2.34 that says that this group that's going to determine the specific services that are going to cover these various, that may include these interventions, some language that says that, and that they are within, in keeping with the, and the term that Mr. McAlpin used for, it's not scope of practice, it's something training.
Scope of training, Madam Chair.
Scope of training. So some language that would be added to it that said that are within the scope of training for the emergency medical technician.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Do you have language?
I would make an oral amendment to that effect. I don't know if the chair typically does make an oral amendment, but I will make an oral amendment, and I would ask Ms. Kavanaugh to help me articulate that.
And Madam Chair, the thing to remember also in 2.32, services may include. It's not a mandatory.
Yes.
So.
But I think in terms of responding to some of the concerns that we've heard, Mr. Tollefson, about the term we typically use in other health professions, the scope, yours is a little different, but I mean, it really highlights that the direction to this group is that it has to be within the scope of training, or that you've got the special terminology that.
Madam Chair,
yes, Senator Lurie.
If you're going to add that, rather than in kind of the generic paragraph A, I mean, you might put it in paragraph B on the next page, which is the list of things, of requirements that need to be there for anything to be eligible for payment. It might be a better place for the concept that you're contemplating if you're going to.
And Madam Chair? Madam Chair, Mr. Parsons had a suggestion instead of scope of training, perhaps skill set?
I prefer the training because it's aligning what it is that's being said, that the competency fits with the educational preparation. That's always what we're concerned about, is that a person has the educational training to fit the set of competencies that they're going to execute. So I really want to stay with that language. And to Senator Lori's suggestion, I really believe that we want that as a guidance in the designing of what the scope of the role is. You know, so I'd really prefer to keep it over there as a guide to the commissioner in consultation with these folks.
Okay, so Madam Chair, there is a suggestion on page 3 after line 12, add a new number 4, consistent with CMT scope of training and skill set.
Excepting there, you're talking about billable in order to be eligible for payment, and I'm referring to describing.
It would be a new paragraph.
I'd like to hear what the recommendation is for the for my amendment.
Yeah, that's what the group is.
Madam Chair, members, on line 2.34 after the period, insert. Any services covered by medical assistance must fall within the scope of training of a CEMT.
It sounds good to some, but it's not speaking to what it is that I am. It's talking about the payment, but it's not talking about the description of the services, which is what Mr. Tollefson is talking about. That as a result of this group, there will be a description of the allowable services for this group, along with which of those will be paid for by medical assistance. So I want not just the medical assistance payment to reference this, but also to direct the Commissioner of Health and Human Services in consultation to design a set of services that are allowable for this group that are in alignment with the training. What was the word, Mr. McElburn, that you used? The scope of training.
Madam Chair.
Senator Eaton and Senator Marty.
I'm thinking if you want the statement to pertain to the CMT, that you want it in the top section, either under A or B.
Or C.
Or C. Because that's where you're talking about the duties rather than the payment. Right. Unlike 2. Because it starts on
2.4. 2.5.
And line number?
2.4 to, well,
2.1. I really am trying to focus on Section 4. Section 4 is where there is language that says the commissioner, in consultation with these representatives, shall determine specified services. That's what I'm talking about, and that those that our guidance to them is in determining those specified services, they must be developed in accordance with the
I guess,
scope of training.
Skill set. Madam Chair.
Okay, then apparently it needs to be in both places. Senator Nelson,
Senator Eaton,
Senator Marty.
I understand where you're going. I think we're all ready to help you write that amendment. Yeah. But it seems to me that on line 2.32, after the word services, if we started with services must be within the scope of training and may include, and then it lists the interventions. That makes it clear in my mind, and maybe that's where you were headed to.
Yes. Madam Chair.
So, Madam Chair, would you like me to make that amendment?
Yes. You can speak to the amendment, Senator, Nelson.
Amendment.
Okay.
Madam Chair, they don't have a scope. This is a skill set, a training skill set. Nurses and people with licensure have scopes. I'm really not comfortable with using that term.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Parsons and Mr. McAlpin would be, and I believe the nurses too, would actually be better served with skill set.
All right, so we'll use the term skill set.
Thank you.
Is that agreeable with you,
Senator? Madam Chair, I would.
Senator Nelson.
Make the amendment then that on line 2.32, after the word services, we insert must be in the skill set.
Within.
The CMET skill set. and may include.
Senator Nelson offers an oral amendment. All those, any further discussion?
I find that acceptable.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment passes. And then finally, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I wanted to say that I thought on that last one, this entire last portion, Section 4, is entirely about what might be funded under medical assistance. And the concern you were having, the one we just put that amendment on, I was going to agree. I think Senator Eaton's right that this is simply about what we're going to pay for under medical assistance. It seems to me you also ought to say at the top that any of the things the CMT may do have to be within their skill set.
And where would you put that amendment, Senator Marty?
Another paragraph under 2.0. After 2.5 or before after 2.3, I'm not sure which one. I'm not sure where it fits, but seems to me that that's where you're talking about what the CMT is able to do. Senator Benson saying they provide services. Yeah, online 2.4 may provide services within the CMT's skill set or skill whatever terminology we're using.
Okay,
and as approved by the medical. It seems to me that that's where you're talking about what they're doing, and that's where you. Really ought to. I mean, the other one's not inappropriate. Just
so on lines 2.4, Senator Marty moves that after the word
services,
that the following language be added
within the whatever language.
What is this?
Within
the
skill set.
CEMT skill set.
Is everybody clear? Any further discussion, Senator Rosen?
That friendly amendment, too.
And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes. Okay, any further discussion on the A1, Senator Nelson?
No, I'm sorry, it's not on the A1. Excuse me, I'm still on these questions after we pass the A1.
We passed the A1.
Okay, so yes.
Oh, we passed the A1, sorry.
My questions to the bill is amended, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
I just wanted to note that it was a little difficult to tell with Mr. Tollefson's testimony what objections applied to the A1 and what applied to the language as introduced. But I will say there was one that I can recall that I don't see addressed here. Maybe Senator Rosen has that. And that is which regulatory board would CEMTs report to? Maybe that's already in statute, but you could just refresh me on that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. It would be the EMT board.
Okay, thank you. Right. And one last comment.
Senator Nelson.
I was just thinking about the communications and how important that is to have all communications in a patient's health record, and I'm hoping there's some communication back to the home health care from the CEMTs. I didn't see that in here, but maybe it is in here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for that, Senator Nelson. It's very important, and as the community paramedic, you have the medical director, you have the primary care provider, and you have the patient. And that is that continuum of care. They all have to report and be responsible to the health care home. And it says that in the patient's health care home 2.11.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Is there any further discussion on the A1 delete all amendment to Senate File 176?
Senator Marty, we
have adopted the A1.
You're on
amendment.
The bill now.
You're on the bill.
Madam Chair.
That's right. Yes, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I need an answer to it tonight, but one of the things Mr. Tollefson said, I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the population-based preventive education, which I think I understand what it is, but he said that a registered nurse with 4 years could not perform that without some additional training, but here somebody else could. And I'm not sure, but maybe this task force or whoever's putting together this, I guess I'm just curious, some of these terms, what kind of training is required by the people who have the proper scope of practice to do these things? I'm not sure I even heard which one he was talking about, but one of them he said 4-year RN could not do without additional training, and here a CEMT was going to be possibly going to be able to do that. But maybe that's for Senator Rosen or whoever's working on this. I don't need an answer today. I just think it would be helpful if we could see who does what and so on.
Thank you, Senator Murray.
Yeah, Senator Rosen,
Madam Chair,
that too. I'm not sure how that fits with all the other things that are in this in terms of seeking to not have frequent returns to the emergency room. How population-based preventive education is so different from what we're talking about here. I'm just very uncomfortable with that language in the bill. I wonder if you'd be open to removing that specific language at this time and allow this committee to.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
So I think the problem that we're having, and I was just trying to get some advice, is most in the room might have a different understanding of what that means based on their experience with it. So you as an advanced practice nurse may see it as what it is, Madam Chair, but I may, as someone not as skilled as you, see it as something a lot broader. So I think part of the issue we have is Senator Eaton as a nurse may have a different level of concern. So if we could define that and understand what that is, I'm not sure. I should speak for myself. I'm not sure I actually know what it means. So if we start to strike things out of a bill and we don't know what the definition of it is, then that becomes problematic because then I don't know.
I see they're having a little conversation there. But Senator Hayden, it's population-based. It's not follow-up on an individual that's been in the emergency room. It's a population-based preventative education. That's very
so maybe
different.
I'll say, what does that mean? And what is the credentials that you need to have in order to do population-based preventative education? So even though I understand what population-based preventative, I understand what my definition of it is, but then who is trained to do it, at what level, at what Mr. Tolleson said that you needed extra training on top of being a four-year nurse in which to do it, but we haven't really defined that. It's just somewhat been anecdotes and innuendo of what we all think that it is, and I think it'd be helpful if we knew what it was.
And I think that's fair to do that. I'm just saying that what I heard the purpose and the function of what this program is about, that is a very unique and very different focus than an individual who's been in the emergency room and is going to be going back home, and then a list of names is provided with a specific workout care plan for that specific patient. Mm-hmm. Is very different than a community-based population prevention plan. So I'm uncomfortable with that particular last piece, and I'm wondering if it could be removed from the bill at this time.
And Madam Chair.
And then Senator Lori also has a comment. I don't know. I'm asking Senator Rosen a question. I guess I'll go to Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, we certainly can take that out. There's been agreement that it can come out. At some point, though, I do believe we need to have a really good discussion about this if we are thinking of expanding the scope of a community, a CMT to child protection or some other, specific population-based issue. And that's where I think that comes in, is that we don't want to limit this, the potential of this CMT to just what is defined right now. It could expand. So we can continue it on. And with that, I could make an oral amendment to delete on page 2, line 3-4, and population-based preventive education, if that makes you more comfortable.
More comfortable.
But the conversation will continue.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. We can have more discussion about it in the committee if they agree with me about that. I want you to know, Senator Rosen, I'm very interested in how we might use this group to be an extension of the eyes and ears that we might need on the ground in the area of child protection. But I think that's a future conversation, and that we can make take action at that time in relationship to what we define, that how we might utilize this resource.
Wonderful. And Madam
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, I think to amend Senator Rosen's amendment at the end of line 2.33, after the comma, we need to insert and, And on line 2.34, after education, delete the comma and insert a period.
Thank you, Senator Benson.
Thank you. Senator Lurie. No. And okay, to the oral amendment, Senator Rosen's oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion passes. Okay, I think we're ready to vote on the bill, unless there's anything further in front of the committee. Senator
Rosen? Chair, with that, I move Senate File 176 as amended be recommended pass and sent to the Committee on Finance.
Finance. Correct. Any further discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
All right. Well, Senator Rosen, welcome to the committee. This is your night.
Non-controversial bill.
This is your night on Senate File 1765.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair,
pardon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1765 is one of four Board of Pharmacy proposals, and this one is the pharmacist immunizations, pharmacy technician ratio, and increasing the size of the board of the pharmacy bill. With that, I have the A15 amendment that I'd like to move, please. It'll delete all amendment.
You all have the A15 amendment. This is a delete all amendment that's being passed out. This is your first hearing. Is this your first hearing on the bill, Senator Rose? I think it is, isn't it? Yes. So this is a delete all. So all those in favor of the A15 delete all amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay. Passes. Okay. So to the bill amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will just briefly walk through it. And then, of course, I have Dr. Weiberg here with me. Section 1 is the pharmacy technician defines what a pharmacy technician does, a little redefinition on that. I don't think that anything controversial there. The next section is the practice of pharmacy, allowing pharmacists to provide immunizations to a greater number of individuals. They've been able to provide immunizations since 2002, and they are currently allowed to administer any vaccine to adults and to administer influenza vaccine to children down to the age of 10. This bill would lower the age of influenza vaccines to 6 and the age for all other vaccines to 13. With that, Madam Chair, I will have an amendment to this, an oral amendment to that section, but I just thought I'd walk through the bill right now.
Okay, thank you.
And to that section of immunizations, the potential for pharmacists to increase immunization rates has been recognized by the Centers of Disease Control, which in 2012 issued a letter stating pharmacists and community vaccinators are uniquely positioned to promote and provide vaccines to people in a wide range of communities. So even though we had the great discussion the other night on immunizations, this is just another vehicle for people to receive their immunizations. We also go into the section for allowing a pharmacist to supervise 3 technicians at a time. Currently, the basic ratio right now in Minnesota, which is one of the lowest in the nation, is 2 technicians to 1 pharmacist. And after much deliberation, the Board of Pharmacy and a coalition of groups that represent pharmacies agree to be to increase the basic ratio to 3 technicians per pharmacist. And then we are also increasing the Board of Pharmacy, and that is currently it stands at 5 pharmacists and 2 public members, and they're increasing it to 3 public members and 6 pharmacists. With that, I do have an oral amendment, Madam Chair, that I'd like to go through. On line 2.6 of the bill, of the A15 amendment, I believe. No?
Jeez.
Katie's got it. Ms. Kavanaugh?
It's on page 1.
Of the new amendment.
Oh, of the new amendment. Okay.
So the amendment. Do you want me to do it?
Yes, like Ms. Kavanaugh to read the amendment and locate it for us.
Madam Chair and members, on page 1, line 27, after the first older? after the first older, insert a semicolon, and then this administering a booster dose or completing a vaccine series, comma, that does not include the initial dose of a vaccine, comma, for patients 13 years of age through 17 years of age, semicolon.
Would you repeat that? Would you repeat that, Senator Wicklund?
Madam Chair, no.
And then on that same line, that 13, reinstate the delete the 13 and reinstate the 18.
So you want me to read
it? Yes. Everybody listening?
Okay, so that on line 27, it would read 6 years of age and older, semicolon, administering a booster dose or completing a vaccine series, comma, that does not include the initial dose of a vaccine, comma, for patients 13 years of age through 17 years of age, semicolon. And then, and all other vaccines to patients 18 years of age and older.
Okay, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question, I want to make sure I understand this correctly. So with that new language, they would be allowed to complete a series for a vaccine but not provide the initial dosing unless they were 18 or older. Is that correct?
13, Madam Chair, Dr. Cody Weiberg, Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy,
Mr.
yes,
Weiberg?
That is what the amendment does.
My second question, Madam Chair. Would this in any way allow for the administering of that vaccination without consultation of the parents for those minor children that would be affected here?
Mr. Weiberg?
Madam Chair, Senator Nienau, no, it would not.
Okay, thank you. So that is an oral amendment. Have we voted on the oral amendment? All those in that's an oral amendment to the delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes. Now to the bill. 1765 is amended. Anything further?
I have, Madam Chair, thank you. I have Dr. Weiberg here that would perhaps like to fill in the gap or
answer questions if there are any.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Cody Weiberg, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Don't have a whole lot more except to say that this particular piece of legislation, which is one of four that we have done a lot of negotiation with a lot of different interested parties on the immunization and the technician to pharmacist ratio portions. And we do think, the board thinks, that the compromise that have been reached are acceptable and that the protection of the public is assured, even though we may have preferred slightly different language. Just speaking to the issue of increasing the size of the Board of Pharmacy, the Board of Pharmacy itself, depending on what statistics you use, is now the third largest health licensing board after nursing and medical practice. And the committee members, you may or may not be aware of this, the committee members don't function solely as like a board of directors for a company where they just meet quarterly and provide strategic direction to staff. There are certain things that only board members can do. We have to have the board members serve on subcommittees that deal with complaints and disciplinary cases, for example. And for reasons we partially understand but don't entirely understand, the complaints that the Board of Pharmacy has received have tripled over the last 3 to 4 years. And some of those complaints are quite significant, quite complicated. Complaints involving, for example, compounding pharmacies out of state that have been illegally shipping into the state. So because of that, we've had to greatly increase the number of committees that the board members have to serve on. And then just as another example, two of our board members, their terms are currently expired. and we're waiting for the governor to reappoint them. Two of the other board members have had, one's had to resign because he was a public member who now works for a pharmaceutical manufacturer, so he can no longer be a public member. And a pharmacist member has to retire, is retiring from practice on April 1st, so she can no longer be a pharmacist member. So to avoid in the future a situation like we have right now, which is we're short on board members, we think it's prudent to increase the size of the board.
Thank you. Are there any questions to Mr. Weiberg? Or Dr. Weiberg, excuse me. Excuse me, Cody. I see that we have Jeff Lindo from Thrifty Pharmacy here.
Madam Chair, actually, because of the change, the oral change that was made, Mr. Lindo and Mr. Simonson will not be testifying. They didn't think
so,
they need to.
So, very good. Thank you, Senator Rosen. So, to the is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill at this time? Seeing no one, I'll pull it back in and close the public hearing. Is there any questions or any further discussion from the committee? So, Senator Rosen, this is to go to the floor. Would you like to make a motion?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 1765, as amended, be recommended, pass, and sent to directly to the floor.
Okay. To the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion passes. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Now we're going to be hearing a presentation on Senate File 1880. Senator Eaton. Just for the general information of the committee and the public, this bill is not before us. There will not be any action taken on the bill. This is simply a presentation by the author of the bill, its purpose, the problem, and the purpose of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. I'd like to thank all of you for hearing the Compassionate Care Act today. My goal is to begin a conversation about this movement for expanded options at the end of life. Many of you heard the very public story of Brittany Maynard, the young California woman with end-stage brain cancer who moved to Oregon to access its death with dignity law. Brittany, faced with months of excruciating headaches, seizures, and neurological symptoms, decided to end her life her own way, peacefully and surrounded by loved ones. 5 states currently allow aid in dying: Oregon, Washington, Montana, New Mexico, and Vermont. Excuse me. And dozens are introducing legislation this year. According to the Gallup, when asked whether they believe physicians should be able to legally end a patient's life by some painless means, most Americans say yes. Support has remained consistent for between 65% and 75% of Americans since 2001. Brittany's story, like many others, raises the question about how we can better relieve suffering at the end of life and return autonomy and control to patients. Today you hear from Pamela White, who is here today to share her family story, and from Dr. David Grub, a family physician, will report on how Oregon has successfully implemented and manages its death with dignity law for more than 17 years. First, I'd like to summarize the basic components of the Compassionate Care Act. The bill is modeled after Oregon's successful death with dignity law. We have included many of the same safeguards for both the patients and the providers. And I lost my spot. As well as mechanisms to prevent misuse. Patients must qualify for compassionate care by being at least 18 years of age, of sound mind, terminally ill, acting of their own free will, and able to self-administer the medication. They must be presented at multiple steps in the process with available alternatives and given the opportunity to change their minds and rescind the request. The bill overview, briefly, is the patient makes a written request. It must be signed by 2 witnesses. At least 1 witness must be neither related nor a beneficiary. The request form must include information about medical alternatives, such as hospice, and the option to rescind the request at any time. and a person does not qualify solely based on age, disability, or specific illness. Upon receiving the first written request, the provider must determine that the patient qualifies, is over 18, competent, and terminally ill, inform the patient of alternatives such as hospice, refer the patient to a consultant who must then confirm the patient's qualifications, diagnosis, prognosis, competency, and that the patient is acting voluntarily. If the consultant does not concur with the referring provider, for example, if the consultant believes the patient to be depressed, the patient must be referred for counseling and no action may be taken until the counseling assessment is completed. If the consultant concurs with the referring doctor, the patient submits a second written request, which can be done no sooner than 15 days from the first written request. Before the prescription is filled, a provider must again offer alternative treatment options, such as hospice, ensure the patient is acting voluntarily, offer the patient the option to rescind. Then the provider will counsel the patient about the use of the medication and what to expect. Providers, physicians, psychiatrists, psychologists, pharmacists are afforded protection as well. Let's see. Use and under the different sections, there's different parts if there's questions later, but I think I'll let the doctor group. Are you starting?
Are you? It's your pleasure.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, you had told us in committee on Friday that we would have an expert who would walk us through the bill and that there would be no public testimony. And so I just want us to be aware that we need just the details of the bill so that we keep this to just the matter at hand and not advocacy.
Yes, I've talked about the issue here is not about advocacy for the bill, but about explaining the bill. But I've also been clear that an articulation, what is the problem that this bill is attempting to resolve? And I think Ms. White's testimony is, I'm expecting that your testimony is about the problem for which you seek this bill. And Dr. Grube, is it Grube?
Grube.
Grube will be talking about this solution to better delineate how this solution is formed and how it's been applied in other places. And that's not advocacy. So I'll continue with you, Ms. White, to be able to describe the problem for which this solution you would propose.
Okay, thank you. Good evening. My name is Pamela White, and I'm a resident of Burnsville, and my parents were long-term residents of Cottage Grove. Both of my parents suffered needlessly at the end of their lives, despite the fact they had made their wishes clear to the family and written health care directives. I still feel pain and remorse when I think of how their lives ended. I want a different experience for myself and my family. In his early 70s, my father underwent multiple surgeries for non-malignant brain tumors that kept coming back. As I look back on this time, I realize that it was out of fear of losing him, my mother's, my sister's, and mine, that we pressured him to have surgical procedures that could not cure him or return him to health. I'm not sure the surgeries even really extended his life, but we wanted him to fight a battle he could not win. He endured the misery to satisfy us. Those years of suffering and indignity, of having to learn to speak again, to work the preschool puzzles, to be constantly misunderstood and underestimated, overshadow the happy times we had together and the noble and intelligent man he was. Then in 2002, at the age of 74, my father was hospitalized with pneumonia. He rapidly deteriorated and was placed on a breathing machine. We were told the infection was reversible and this was his best chance to survive. So holding out hope, we agreed to an intubation. But as the days went by, my sister, my mother and I realized that this had been a mistake. Although we all had the best of intentions, we had no idea of the agony my father would suffer until unable to speak, he looked at us with pleading eyes as he tore at the oxygen cord. After 10 days on a ventilator and extremely uncomfortable despite medication, it became clear that he was not going to improve and his suffering had to end. We requested that life support be withdrawn and watched in horror as he struggled to breathe, drowning in his own fluids before us. Losing a father and husband is difficult, but our grief was compounded by guilt. We had allowed my father to suffer, exactly what he had not wanted. We failed to help him die in peace at home, and we did it out of ignorance and fear. We learned a painful lesson from this experience and were resolute. This wasn't going to happen again. None of us wanted this kind of ending for our lives. Sometimes we even talked about flippantly about taking that trip to Oregon. 11 years later, at the age of 80, my mother was diagnosed with bladder cancer that had spread to her spine. She underwent radiation and chemotherapy, but it was more than she could tolerate. She was increasingly weak and in pain. I remember so clearly the day we sat in the chemo area at the clinic awaiting another treatment when she told me it was time for that trip to Oregon. Based on her request, I investigated further and learned that since she was not a resident of Oregon and didn't have an established doctor there, it was really not a viable option. It seemed my mother had no choice. She was given a 15% chance of survival and warned that the chemo was going to be grueling. Our lives turned into a circle of pain and disappointment and sadness. Complications from treatment were significant. Mom suffered a blood clot in her lung. She vomited uncontrollably and was hospitalized several times and had to be fed by vein. At home, she fell in the tub, and my sister had to get our uncle, her brother, to help her get up. It was horrible for her and for us. My mother had a lot of pride and dignity. She hated being reduced to a sick and helpless rag doll. She requested hospice, stating, "This is not living." But even with hospice, she felt humiliated. She fought receiving baths by strangers, help with personal hygiene, and especially help with her false teeth. In all my life, I'd never seen my mother without her false teeth. She hated every minute and wanted to escape. She lived another 2 months. She was courageous, but this again was a battle she could not win. She grew increasingly weak and disconnected as the disease took its downward course. At times, she shook uncontrollably, and we gave her medicine for anxiety. This period is still like a nightmare to me. 1 month before her 81st birthday, my mother finally passed away. What remains is the fear that I, too, could be stuck with misery and suffering at the end of my life. I don't want my family to feel the guilt and powerlessness that I did. Suffering at the end of life is cruel and unnecessary. Minnesotans, too, deserve freedom to die at home in peace and on their own terms.
Thank you, Ms. White. Dr. Grubb?
Madam
again,
Chair.
I want to be clear. You know, I've communicated that what we're here about is the presentation of what's in the bill. We've articulated a problem, a series of problems that this would have created an option for, and so we want to stay focused on the bill and on what you may be able to help us to understand about what others have experienced with this bill or what you know about. Should something like this be implemented in Minnesota, what you can tell us about that?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Grubb. I'm a retired family doctor. I practiced for 35 years in a teeny little town in Oregon, but my practice partner was from Redwood Falls, Minnesota, and a wonderful doctor who actually was Oregon's Family Doctor of the Year a couple of years ago, so you can be very proud of your educational system for doctors. So this bill that Senator Eaton has proposed and other senators are proposing is very similar to the Oregon bill, quite modeled on the Oregon bill. And we've had the Oregon bill now for 18 years in effect. And so it's working, and we're not having problems that were anticipated. The there Each year, the legislature and the health department look to see if there are any problems with the bill and how it's, are there any issues, and there haven't been any changes in the bill, which makes, there are not too many bills so they don't get changed after 18 years, so it's going, it's working fine. I think the reason for the bill is for about patient autonomy, and that's, I strongly believe in patient autonomy, that my patient should be able to be informed, to understand what they want, and then choose what they would like to do. I think that should probably the biggest benefit of this bill itself. I have a lot of experience and would be really happy to answer any questions that any members of the committee might have as a resource for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you very much, Senator Eaton, for the presentation. Are there any questions or discussion or information gathering that the committee would like to have at this time?
Senator Benson. Chair, I'd just like to state, last Friday you told us one person just to the facts. We've now had a very emotional story that was clearly advocacy, and I've had a dozen people call my office who wanted to testify. I can't imagine what your office experienced in people who wanted to oppose this, and this was clearly advocacy, and it feels like the continuation of the press conference that was held today, setting forth public hearings and drumming up support for a highly controversial issue, and I do not think it is the best we could do in the Senate on an issue of this level of controversy. And so, respectfully, Madam Chair, I have nothing else to add at this point.
Thank you for your input on that, Senator Benson. I don't think that there's any way that a person can present a bill and not be an advocate for it. It's obvious that by the fact that it's being presented, it is a group of people that are believing that there is a problem which was described. It's very difficult to describe a problem and seek a response to it without others perceiving that as advocacy. But I understood that the presentation was to articulate what the problem was and a presentation on what the contents of the bill are. And the doctor is here to be able to answer questions about experience, actual experience with an implementation of a bill like this. At this time, it's a resource available to the committee to use as they choose. Sarah Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first, my heart goes out to Ms. White. I think we've all been in very similar situations. But I will also add that I noticed you mentioned advanced directives. And I think that's something that we can all agree upon, is how important it is that people take the time to fill out advanced directives, and that their loved ones and their family members spend time with them talking about what are these advanced directives, what do you wish, what don't you wish. And I think that is a direction that would be very helpful in situations like this. And some of those advanced directives include no intubation, no CPR. So I think that is something for us to think about. And then lastly, Madam Chair, I thought part of the discussion was that this is the beginning of a statewide discussion about this very important issue. And I would say that I'm disappointed that we would have a one-sided start to any very important, emotionally laden, very controversial issue. I'm hoping that any further discussions have a very broad appeal to testifiers and people who are involved in this very in these very painful situations. Thank you.
Senator Rosen. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had a question. Anything? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not really going to make do much in the way of commentary or ask any questions because we don't have a proposal before us today, and for the sake of the committee members' time, I'm not going to make a long speech either. Part of the reason for that is because we don't have a proposal before the committee today, and quite frankly, it would be doing a great disservice to the seriousness of the issue to get into that without both sides at the table. In the event that this proposal is before this committee at some point, it sounds like it won't be this session, but potentially next year, I do have probably dozens of questions, and there are probably dozens of concerns with the language in the bill, and I will ask those, and we will have the opportunity to take a look at what those concerns are, and I would hope for a robust, probably lengthy, and very serious balanced discussion about the subject.
Of course. I do have some questions. Dr. Grub, you in your brief testimony indicated that that in your experience of 18 years there haven't been modifications to the bill in Oregon, that the bill is similar. Could you talk about how it's dissimilar from the Minnesota bill, and could you talk about what your experience is in terms, you talked about some fears of what might happen. What were what are those fears that did not happen? And what is the utilization, what is the actual utilization of the of your particular law? But first, how is what you have experienced with different than what is in front of us?
So how the two, how our law is different from this proposal that it might be. The main thing is in Oregon, a person comes and talks to the doctor and has an oral request, then has to come back in 15 days and have a second oral request to that same doctor, and go to another doctor and have an oral request, and then somewhere during that time, but after two doctors have been evaluated the patient, have a written request. In the Minnesota thing that we're proposing, I don't know quite the name of it, is that there's two written requests. We only have one written request, and we but it's similar in that there's two doctors involved, so that it can be very clear what that the patient qualifies under the statute.
And the fears that were not realized?
Well, there are
and
quite...
And how much utilization are you seeing this?
So utilization is very small. Last year, 155 Oregonians requested and received prescriptions. 105 Oregonians took those, so about two-thirds, which has been traditional over most years. And there were 34,000 deaths in Oregon. So 105 people out of 34,000 is 0.2%. Not very many. It's a small group.
And the fears that were not realized?
Yes, so there are some fears that are concerned. One is the fear that hospice and palliative care will be undermined, and that's absolutely not the case, because in Oregon, a hospice association, which had been opposed to it, now is not opposed to it and actually encourages choice at end of life, a 180-degree switch. So it doesn't undermine palliative care or hospice care at all. There's been a fear that it would be there would be a duty to die, that people would feel obligated that they had to take the prescription because they were a burden on their family. That is not the case. Many studies have been shown that doesn't seem to be happening. The slippery slope, this is the first step of something more. There's been nothing more. That the law hasn't changed in 18 years. That the underprivileged or disabled would be impacted by this. And if you look at the statistics, the facts, actually, it's a very highly educated group of people who opt this. They have a much higher degree of education, for example, than the population as a whole. So those are some of the ones.
And I guess I'll pass on that question. Are there any other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, you had mentioned...
I'm sorry, Senator Hoffman first, and then...
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I like Senator Nienau, have many questions regarding the process, the role. And this is by far probably one of the most passionate debates that I will ever involve myself in. I believe what you're bringing to the state of Minnesota is wrong, and I'm going to withhold judgment. Those that know me, I don't want to get too bombastic in this chamber, or get loosey goosey. But I will definitely say that I question why we're even hearing this bill. It's not a bill. Let me take that back. It's an information session, because we have so many good bills out there that are not getting heard because of the time constraint now we're coming up to. And I just think that this should have been something that should have been vetted longer, especially because There are some things that get me. Due process clause is number one. You're going to have a legal discussion on that. Slippery slope, consent. Talk about consent. Why do we even need consent? You know, and I've used examples of what doctors have done in other countries regarding how that camel gets underneath that tent, the nose, and starts to do some slide to Auschwitz type of things. And I personally don't want to be part of that piece because I think it's wrong, especially when you get to then healthcare costs. Lots of questions about how Oregon uses it as a health benefit versus anything else. And again, I'm not going to take up the time here on that, but do note that I do want to have that discussion because if we're going to talk about that, who's going to control the HMOs and the PMPs and the whoosie wuzzits out there that are control what is a benefit or not? Those are my concerns. These are not questions I don't want you to respond to because I'm sitting here right now. I'm opposed to this conversation because I think it's wrong. Government involvement, we had the baby dole legislation from the 80s that had to step in and say to the feds that you're withholding funds in hospitals without life-saving treatment is wrong. So those kinds of things that I'm afraid we're going to enter into a discussion that we're going to get down the road and it's going to be harmful and hurtful. And so with that, I'm going to feel the physiological changes in my own body and say I'm going to stop comments right there and say, Madam Chair, I have deep concerns.
Are there any more questions about what is in the bill? Senator Benson.
Mine is to process, Madam Chair. So when you have concluded your...
Senator Eaton, I would just want you to... Would you restate again what it is the bill does? And if you want to, you can speak to this question that I thought was asked about whether or not this, under this bill, if this is a benefit, if this is a benefit that's paid out by medical assistance or any other program under your bill. So please describe what your bill does do.
Madam Chair, first of all, I want to say that I very much respect everybody's opinion on this, and that's why I want to do the listening sessions over the summer. I don't think we could be here long enough to have the actual debate. I just wanted people to be aware of what my bill said so they knew what they were debating. So my bill essentially gives people a choice. It lets people decide how they will die. If you are terminal and you're dying no matter what, you're going to be dead in the next 6 months no matter what you do, I think you should have the right to decide, if you want, how that death will occur.
And that's that what you're thinking is now advocacy. So, but what the bill does is allow for an action to be taken in the last 6 months if there's a terminal diagnosis.
Correct. Generally, someone's in a lot of pain, or they hear how their disease will progress, and they, some of the people who don't use it end up just glad they got the medication because then they felt the relief of knowing they had a way out if it got too bad, and they never did use it. So I think it relieves some anxiety for people who are undergoing some hellish. I mean, these people are really, really sick, and.
So I just want to state of the contents of the bill, and not our opinions about the bill at this time. And so I just want to be clear that it's at the end of life. A physician prescribes a medication, does not give the medication, it's self-administered. There's a process that of check, recheck, recheck, recheck. There is a that's defined in the bill. There is considerations for the treatment of depression in order to make certain that the decision is not out of some limitation in cognitive functioning.
That's the referral to the third doctor if there is a concern about that. And, you know, as a third-year professional in mental health, yeah. I strongly support that. I do not condone suicide. Mm-hmm. These people will be grieving, but not clinically depressed.
And then there is not a liability for the physician who prescribes the medication, but is it now a requirement that a physician provide this service?
No doctor is obligated. no patient is obligated to use the service.
And there has to be witnesses. There has to be witnesses. Two witnesses. One right. has to be not a relative of the person,
and not a beneficiary or somebody who will benefit from that person's okay. death. And it also you have to be able to take the medication yourself. It cannot be administered by anybody else. You can't have. I've heard people. Some of the emails I got about IVs, and that's not in this bill. That's not allowed. Okay. So that. I've heard complaints about people with ALS then wouldn't be able to use it, but, okay. you know.
All right. Senator Benson, you had something further, I think?
Madam Chair, yes. process question. The listening sessions advocacy groups, I presume, are going to be going out in the interim, but will you, Madam Chair, be scheduling any public hearings for this once we're out of session and into interim?
You know, I haven't decided about that yet. It's possible first of all, it's possible that we'll have some hearings out of the Capitol because we will be out of the Capitol at the end of this month. And so I'm beginning to think about how might we have some hearings throughout the state in Duluth and Wilmer. And we may put this, if we have a hearing, we may put this on for further public dialogue and public input, but there certainly would be notice, as there would be about any hearing, and an allowance for public input. But that may—I haven't completely decided about that. But I know that Senator Eaton has indicated that she is planning to have some listening sessions around the state to present what the contents is and to listen to what the general community is thinking about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I'm not willing to commit to what my plan will be for the summer as of yet. But if there is public hearings and this is on the agenda, then there will be public input and we'll be recording that. And there will not be a vote on any of this until we come back into, and I'm not even sure there will be a vote next year, but the soonest we would have a vote would be we'd have to actually take this up as a bill and allow for public testimony. And I'm certain that it would take a full hearing to allow for public testimony, and we probably move the bill over to another hearing for actual discussion by the committee, as we have in other controversial bills in the past. But that's all out in the future. I just know we're not going to take any action tonight, and the committee is not going to take any action during the interim or the summer on this bill. Any further discussion? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam
thank
Chair.
You. Thank I'd you, like to thank Senator Sharon, members of the committee, for hearing the Compassionate Care Act today. I know it wasn't easy for a lot of you. Thank you.
Okay, on Senate File 454, thank you very much for coming and testifying this evening. This is the Physician Assistant Program Provisions Modifications.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 454 is largely a housekeeping bill that was brought to me by the Minnesota Academy of Physicians Assistants. The bill makes no changes in the scope of practice of physicians assistants. I don't believe there's any controversy with this bill. I've not received a word of any concerns from either organizations or individuals. The House companion was heard several weeks ago with no opposition testimony, and I appreciate the committee members that have co-authored the bill with me. In a moment, I will turn things over to Tracy Kaiser of the Minnesota.
Leslie.
Nope. I guess I have a different person.
That's me.
Leslie Melter. Anyway, of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants. She'll walk through the bill for
you. Okay, thank you. Welcome, Ms. Melter.
Oh, I do have an author's amendment. I don't know what the number is, though.
There's an A1 author's amendment. This is the first hearing, so Senator Eaton offers the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment passes. Now to the bill as amended. Ms. Miltier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Leslie Miltier. I'm the president-elect for the Minnesota Academy of PAs. I'm also a practicing physician assistant in family practice in Blaine. If I may clarify for you, Madam Chair and the members, the A1 amendment modifies existing reporting requirements by physician assistants to their licensing board, which is the Board of Medical Practice. Currently, PAs must notify the board in writing before they can begin practice where they will be practicing. PAs are the only licensed healthcare professional in the state of Minnesota that is required to file such information with the licensing board. The board keeps a list of the authorized prescribers in case they receive questions from the pharmacy if prescription is valid, and the notice of intent to practice is how the board was assessing this information. It is also used by the board to track work locations for PAs for the purpose of the prescription monitoring program and other pharmacy-related issues. The amendment changes the notification to a practice notification, which would be filed within 30 business days of the PA beginning practice, or changing their practice, or any changes to their supervision or delegation agreements. It will continue to be used by the board to maintain the data required by PAs, prescribers, and their locations. But the proposed change and amendment will no longer delay a PA from beginning practice by the notice of intent. Make an author's amendment, or if we already accepted it.
It's already accepted.
Well, it's already accepted. So thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep going then. Before we continue, I'd like to express that I was at the Board of Medical Practice meeting on March 14th. We've been working very collaboratively with the Board of Medicine to change the wording to the notice of intent to practice to the notice of practice location. It's been a very collaborative discussion, and the board remained neutral on the bill. The first piece of the bill deals with the supervision of PAs. PAs do not have independent practice authority. They must have a written agreement with a supervising physician that outlines what their scope of practice will be. This bill does not change that. Minnesota's PAs believe that the collaborative partnership between PAs and their supervising physician works well, and the team-based care model is the foundation of PA practice. However, current law requires a PA to maintain a list of alternate supervising physicians. The purpose of the list is to keep a record of other physicians working with the PA in the supervisory role when the primary supervising physician is not available. This agreement is identical to the primary supervising agreement and does not change the scope of practice for the PA. This requirement was believed to have been enacted early on in the PA practice laws when PAs practiced in very small local settings with one or two physicians or one or two PAs. That's not how PAs practice today. Today, much of the outpatient care is delivered in large multi-specialty clinics that may have dozens or even hundreds of physicians. Similarly, PAs practice in hospital ERs, surgical suites, may work with a dozen or more different physicians in the course of their shift. The bill's removal of the legislative alternate supervising physician, placing this determination back at the practice level. This move allows the practice to determine which PA, which physician the PA will work with, and the documentation methods needed to keep accurate records reflecting that working relationship. This elimination is in sections 1, 3, and 5 of the bill. On a personal note, I work in a family practice group that has over 18 physicians in it, and on Saturdays, we all rotate through one specific location. Prior to me being able to attend to the Saturday clinic, we had to obtain signatures from every one of the 18 physicians in my practice, because on any given Saturday, I may work with any two of those physicians. It may not be my primary supervising physician, but I'm always in attendance with two of the physicians at the practice site. I was delayed from being able to provide those services because of the 3.5 weeks it took because of supervising, because of vacation schedules and practice schedules to obtain the alternate physician prescriptions that were needed for the licensing. Removal of the alternate supervising physician would have reduced that time. Section 2 of the bill is a policy issue. Under current law, a physician may have supervision agreements with no more than 5 PAs. We're not sure where the number 5 came from or why 5 is better than 6 or worse than 4. The bill's removal of this ratio from statute places this decision back at the practice level. Given how healthcare is changing, particularly in rural settings, caps don't make sense and can often limit care. North Dakota has eliminated their cap. It's being considered in South Dakota, and 11 other states have eliminated care caps or supervision caps. Removal of the ratio from legislation is supported by the American Medical Association, American Academy of Family Physicians, American College of Surgeons, and the Federation of State Medical Boards. I can give you an example. A practice colleague from the Minnesota Academy works in a rural area in southern Minnesota. She is aware of a very specific circumstance where two physicians supervised 4 physician assistants each in rural settings, supplying not only an urgency center but a family practice office. When one of those physicians decided to leave the practice, that required four physician assistants to stop rendering care because the ratio would have been out of balance for the remaining physician. It's an average time of 6 to 9 months to find a replacement physician when a physician gives notice. And as a result of the ratio, those four physician assistants were no longer able to provide care in an area that is already considered underserved. As noted earlier in Section 3 of the bill is another repeal of the alternate supervising physician. Section 4 of the bill redirects the reviser of statute to fix typos with how physician assistant is referred to throughout the state statutes. Section 5 is another repeal of the alternate supervising physician and the change to the notice of practice location provision that was adopted in the earlier amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that is wishing to be heard on this bill at this time? Seeing no one, let's close the public hearing portion of, and bring it into the committee for any questions for the testifiers. Seeing none?
Madam Chair,
would you like to make a motion, Senator Eaton?
I'd like to move Senate File 454 be passed as amended and sent to
the floor. On Senator Eaton's motion, any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Eaton. And that concludes the business of the committee. And we are adjourned.